Okay, so welcome back. So, as I was saying earlier, tonight we've got the final evening, for the time being anyway, on our series called The Yogi's Joy, which is based on the songs of Milarepa. We've been loosely basing it on this book by Sangharakshita, which is great. I do thoroughly recommend this book. But as I say, even if you've not been here for the other weeks, hopefully this evening will stand alone. So we've heard lots about this character called Milarepa. So I'm not going to say much about him. So he's the yogi in question. And he lived in medieval Tibet. And he was a hermit. In his later life, he had a very adventurous life. He became a hermit and he meditated and he sang. That was the way he taught. He taught through song. He didn't just teach through song, he just sang anyway. So he just sang. So what I'm going to be concentrating on tonight is the joy part. So it's very interesting that this is called The Yogi's Joy, and that Milarepa was a very joyful character, even though he had, in worldly terms, he had nothing. He just dressed, even in the colds of winter, in just this thin cotton cloth. As we've heard, he lived on nettles reputedly, so much so that his skin turned green. That was all he ate, was nettles. But yet, he was just overflowing with joy and singing. And it's interesting that Sangharakshita, our founder of Tri Ratna and our teacher, has been particularly inspired and even influenced by Milarepa. So on one of his... he's still alive, Sangharakshita, but he's not doing really public talks these days because he's very old now. He's nearly 90. But on one of his last sort of public addresses, he talked about Milarepa as a particular influence. He said his inspirations were the Buddha, Dr. Ambedkar, who's a more recent historical character, who worked in India in the 1950s and was instrumental in this mass conversion to Buddhism of Indian people, and Milarepa. So those were the three figures. So it's quite interesting to me what it is about Milarepa that so inspired Sangharakshita. It's also the figure that Sangharakshita has led the most seminars on. And I think a clue probably is in the song and poetry and the joy. I think that's a clue. Because Sangharakshita himself has really, really emphasised again and again that if we're not experiencing joy, or if we, maybe that's not quite the right way to put it, if we don't sort of value joy in our spiritual life, we've kind of got the wrong end of the stick, basically. So I'm just going to tell you a few things that he said about this that I find quite heartening. So this is Sangharakshita. He says, some religious texts talk about the need to give up worldly pleasure or happiness. But I would personally like to see people giving up their attachment to worldly misery. So I really like that. And I think that's quite good, isn't it? And I give this pause for thought. It makes me pause for thought of, am I attached to worldly misery rather than pleasure or happiness? And I have to confess, I can be. And certainly in my younger life I was, and in my pre-Buddhist life when I was a Christian, I definitely was quite attached to worldly misery. It was my biggest ambition to be a martyr, I think. You know, I really, really loved the stories of the martyrs and wanted to be one, and I don't think that's fully left me. That sort of the equating of suffering with some sort of spiritual progress, I think, is certainly that's been strong in my own history. And I think even in a more secular way, I think in sort of equating suffering with virtue can sort of sneak into our lives. I don't know if any of you do this, but if you've ever found yourself involved in a conversation where sort of pain and suffering's almost become a currency, you know, that one person says, oh, you know, I worked like 65 hours last week, and the other one says, oh, but I, you know, stayed up all night or something. You know, almost, because, yeah, that in itself becomes, yeah, kind of currency, a kind of mark of, I don't know, dedication or some sort of virtue. I don't know, maybe it's just me. Does anyone recognise that kind of thing? Yeah. So Sangharaksha is right from the outset saying this is just really, if we're doing that in our lives, especially if we're doing it in our Dharma lives, we've got the wrong end of the stick. So he, and particularly in his teaching, he's emphasised beauty, he's emphasised joy, he's drawn that out of the Buddha's teachings. It's always been there in the Buddha's teachings, but it's been somewhat neglected, and Sangharaksha has been at pains to draw out the aspect of beauty, of joy. Again, just another little quote from him on this. He says, if in your attempts to live a spiritual life you become anxious, make yourself wretched, and insist on working yourself into a state of exhaustion, something has clearly gone wrong. So again, that's a kind of warning, really. And maybe I've noticed these things because I seem to be the kind of character that can easily fall into that. Jnanavach is not, I don't think. I think he's quite at home with joy. So that's great. That's a very good condition from that point of view. Yeah. So as I say, I think this emphasis of beauty, of joy, helps to counteract that tendency that some people, me included, has of using the very Dharma life itself as a reason to give oneself or other people a hard time. And I think, well, for me, that's certainly been barely conscious a lot of the time. I don't really know what I'm doing or why. But I just can't quite stop looking for suffering of some kind. So I personally became very excited when I came across the teachings of the Dharma, particularly those that pointed to the fact that opening to beauty, opening to joy, was allowed in a way, was a kind of, not just allowed but encouraged, was actually a path. As well as my excitement, I quite quickly realised it's also a challenge as well, because it can go against the grain of, well, maybe particularly Western culture, which can tend to be a bit more cynical. But I think opening to beauty and joy does mean opening to something unknown. I think there can be a sort of almost comfort zone in the more martyr-like suffering approach, even though it's unpleasant. There's a sort of safety in it. One, you know, you sort of know where you'd stand. So that's by way of sort of preamble to the subject of tonight, which I'm going to hopefully talk a little bit, and hopefully there's a chance for some discussion. And what I'm going to use for the sort of main body of what I'm going to say is actually an article written by Maitreya Banda, who's another teacher at the centre here, who many of you know. He wrote it for a poetry magazine, and it's just an article that I've returned to again and again, and I thought, oh well, this is an opportunity to share it with you, but also to discuss it with you. So I've sort of edited it a bit because it was written in a particular context for this poetry magazine, as I say, but what I've done is I've taken out what I think are the main points, and I think, that could generate some thoughtfulness from us. So the article is called The Provenance of Pleasure. And straight away he sort of does a bit of a critique of this word pleasure, or this notion of pleasure, because it can have connotations of something a bit trivial, of just something like entertainment or selfish gratification, if you just think of the word pleasure on its own. But he gives a new definition, actually. He takes it from a poet called David Constantine. So he defines pleasure as end in itself, servant to nothing other than what it carries, love. So end in itself, servant to nothing other than what it carries, love. So that's important that we've got that definition, and that's what I want to explore in talking about pleasure. I'm kind of using joy and pleasure a bit interchangeably. They're maybe not completely interchangeable, but I think for the purpose of this, it does fine. So some of this first bit will be familiar ground, but it's always good to be reminded. So one thing, I think it's always worth reminding ourselves of, is Buddhism started with the Buddha. I mean, this might seem very obvious to many of us, but it started off with a person who became the Buddha. And it was a person who, before he became the Buddha, was involved in a struggle, was questing what is life about, and particularly what can life be about if it just ends in suffering, old age and death. There must be more. So Buddhism began with the Buddha, and it began with a person on a quest. It didn't begin with anything abstract. It didn't begin with a theory. Even the Buddha himself didn't begin with a theory. I think this is really important to keep reminding ourselves of, that the Buddha wasn't and isn't a theoretician, even though he is a thinker. He's not a sort of a metaphysician. And actually that would have been quite radical in the day of the Buddha, because he would have been surrounded by sort of abstract, metaphysical and speculative thought. But the Buddha came along and he was practical and pragmatic, and he was interested in method rather than doctrine. The central question was, what to do about suffering, what to do about this problem of suffering. And he taught individual men and women how to make progress towards enlightenment. Once he'd gained enlightenment, characterised, as we know, by compassion, energy, wisdom, he then taught individual men and women towards that. So that's as basic. And why I'm saying this particularly is because I'm going to give us a few models this evening, but just to say that they are just models. They're just ways of approaching the Buddha's experience, rather than sort of theories that are claiming to explain everything. So So here's a model, and it's from a sutta called the Honeyball Sutta that some of us all know. And according to this sutta, experience, all our experience, has three aspects. So, firstly, we come into contact with things. Yeah? So that's quite straightforward. We see things, hear things, touch things, and smell things with our sense organs. And Buddhism, because Buddhism includes the mind as a sense organ, then we come into contact with mind objects as well, like memories, like dreams, like a poem, you know, things that make an impression on our minds. Okay, and then everything we come in contact with, whatever that is, the crisp autumnal, or rather the rainy autumnal weather today, the thought of what we'll do later after the class, you know, how we're feeling, how we are right now, it feels like something. It feels either pleasant or unpleasant or neutral. That's just a given, and the Sanskrit word for that is vedana. So again, that's possibly familiar to many of us. That's just a given. It's kind of, in an ethical sense, it's neutral. It's just a sort of fact of life. And thirdly, all experience entails some degree of interpretation or labelling. So we'll call things something, we'll call things dark or light or warm or father or something. That capacity to make distinctions is called samnya. So there's not going to be loads of Buddhist words in this talk, but there's going to be a few. So that's samnya. So you've got these three aspects. You've got contact, you've got feeling tone, and then you've got the naming. And that's what you might call our primary reality. And we share this with all other living creatures, cats and dogs and mice and rats and so on. That's just part of being a creature, that we have those things. So even an animal will be, you know, if a mouse sees a cat, presumably it knows that's a threat. Yeah, so even, yeah, up to that point, we shared that with all creatures. But what we've got, of course, that's on the whole, animals don't. It's quite interesting, and just as an aside, when Buddhism, there isn't that sort of this completely distinct line between animals and human beings. It's not like Christianity, say, that draws a very firm line and that humans have got souls and animals haven't. There's a sort of shading. There's a shading between animal and human in Buddhism. But on the whole, what makes us human, or rather than animal, you could say, is that we've got reflective consciousness. We can stand back from our mind and have a look at what's going on, and question ourselves about it. So we can make ourselves the object of our attention. So we can actually ask ourselves, well, why am I feeling anxious? Why am I feeling threatened? How do I need to act just now? We can stand back and take stock of all this. In a way, decide. And we decide what to do next. So we can, that's what we're trying to do when we become mindful. We can become mindful of pleasant or unpleasant or neutral, and try not to react unhelpfully to them. That's our sort of training and mindfulness, isn't it? So, you know, we can tell ourselves, oh goodness, I just need to calm down, I just need to feel my feet on the floor. Or we can tell ourselves, oh, actually, it'd be really helpful if I went and talked to a friend just now. So one more Sanskrit word. So the Sanskrit word for this faculty, actually there's going to be a few more Sanskrit words, but one more just now, is vitarka, which you could call intelligence. So it's our capacity to reason and decide how best to act. It's not often that fully developed, but it is, it's the gift we've got, and it means we can be aware. And it's quite interesting, isn't it, to remember that that's positive, that because we can, why I'm saying that is, in the meditation class the other day, in the newcomers part of the class, somebody was teaching the Metta Bhavana, and a question which wasn't an uncommon question came, which is, why are we being instructed to sort of use our minds to reflect in these ways when meditation, so this person had been thought, was about stopping thinking. I think that's quite a common view, that meditation is about stopping thinking. But actually, that's not the most helpful way to look at meditation, certainly in the beginning stages, is to see, it's more helpful, I think, to see, can we move from the sort of underdeveloped scatter type of thought to more directed thinking that then we could truly call intelligent thinking. Usually what we call thinking is just, we're just sort of stuck in repetitive inner narratives going round and round in circles. You know, our minds kind of ranging around trying to make sense of experience, trying to make connections, connecting this and that, going over things, sort of rehearsing things, either going over things from the past or rehearsing what we're going to say. It's embarrassing, isn't it? It's embarrassing to me to see how I do that. I call it my sort of letter to the times mode when I'm thinking what I'll just say to that, you know, what I'll just say in response to that. Often what we call thinking is that sort of more that cacophony. Maitreya Banda calls it in his article rather wittily, that it's a bit like a 50 pence clattering round and round in the tumble dryer. And we all experience that, don't we? I'm sure it's not just, well, I know it's not just me, because it's part of what comes with the territory of having a mind, really. And it can be, you know, it can be relatively weak. It can just be a sort of burbling along. Or it can, you know, it can become very painful, actually. It can be a real cacophony of, well, why is this happening to me? Or why does this always happen to me? It can be something we almost, kind of torture ourselves with, actually. So that's not intelligent thinking. You might know the Sanskrit word for that. That's prapancha. That's the Sanskrit word for that's prapancha. It literally means spreading out. It means making things complicated. It means mental proliferation. What we're trying to do is to solve the sort of problems of pleasure and pain. What we're trying to do is we'll work out why we're suffering when we think we should be happy. So we're trying to, when we're going round and round this, we're trying to kind of think, well, what's caused this pain and how can I get out of it and how can I avoid it in the future? It's a sort of tragic attempt, really, to get out of it. It's tragic because it can't get out. Well, just like that 50 pence going round and round the tumble dryer, it can't. It's just too much on its own level to get us out. What's to make things worse in a way is what happens is that not only is that painful in the moment, but it sort of gets us into a, it, settle, it gets into a settled mode. So then we kind of get stuck inside something we've constructed, and we start reinterpreting the world in the light of that. So then we start fitting our experience into our construction. It's so painful, isn't it? You can really see it when other people do it. It's really hard to do it yourself. See it yourself. You can really see your friends. Can't you just interpret the world in a particular way that you can see is going to cause them pain? You can, but probably they can see you, i.e. oneself, doing the exact same thing. But it's very, very hard to see ourselves because... yeah, it's like trying to almost see the back of your own head or something. But do you know what I mean when I say you can see your friends sort of doing that, repeating patterns or setting up their view of the world to make self-fulfilling prophecies happen? You know, you can see your friends say, oh, I knew they were going to say no to that. But you from the outside can see, ah, I can see how you set it up so they would say no. But, and if you're skillful enough, you might be able to help them to see how they did that. But, you know, the embarrassing fact is they can see us doing it as well. So that's what we're doing. Oh yes, my tribe bander, he says in a really kind of quite poetic way, he says, our mind both casts a spell, kind of distorting, even contaminating our experience, and at the same time is under a spell. So our settled convictions, we're under the spell of our settled convictions. And that is all what we all do nearly all the time, and it's painful and it adds to our pain, and it's the opposite of enlightenment. Enlightenment is the opposite of it. So this, as I said, is prapancha, what we're doing. So an epithet for enlightenment is nisprapancha or no prapancha, the relief of stopping doing it and just seeing things clearly. So I'm sure we recognise what I've said so far, but there's another bit to it. So if we go back to what I said before about that everything has feeling tone or vedana, pleasant, painful or neutral. But the next bit, and the bit that sort of really is the nub of this whole subject of joy and pleasure, is that Vedana itself is subdivided into two kinds of pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral. And these are called, more Sanskrit words, Samisa or Niramisa. Okay, so... Samisa means feelings, literally it means feelings related to the flesh. So it means basically worldly feelings. And Niramisa means feelings connected to renunciation. So just because that might sound a bit sort of moralistic, we're going to explore that a bit more. But it's interesting because The Niramisa is connected with renunciation. If we go back to our yogi Milarepa, who is the kind of great renunciate, he's the great renunciate, but yet he's experiencing joy all the time, which is outpouring in these songs. So what do we mean if we want to make sure we're not getting too sort of narrowly moralistic about this? So... well, maybe this is a time to pause and ask you. So if we stick to just pleasant, we won't do the painful or neutral tonight. So if we've got some pleasant that is worldly, and some pleasant that's connected with renunciation. So another way you could say it is we've got some pleasant that leads to unskillful and some pleasant that's skillful. So what do you think makes a difference? What do you think makes it?
To do with your level of attachment.
Yeah, that's it. So basically that's it. So that's the difference, is whether it's associated with craving or not. So basically, niramisa, that's the one that's associated with renunciation, is less addictive and less narcotic even than samisa. So niramisa doesn't, because it's not bound up with craving, it doesn't have the sort of sting in the tail, it doesn't have the morning after the night before sort of feeling. And it doesn't kind of lead you to, it doesn't sort of lead you into further craving. So the pleasant niramisa leaves us feeling richer and more content, whereas pleasurable samisa, the one associated with craving, kind of just it fuels more compulsion to find and then repeat pleasure. So remembering that when I say unskillful, that doesn't mean bad in a moralistic sense. It means something more like it doesn't really work, or it only works in the short term. But actually, in the longer term, it makes things worse. It actually makes the pleasure we experience kind of less, really. It's a sort of law of diminishing returns. So what you could say about the Dharma life, one very sort of simple but yet valid way of looking at the Dharma life is that we can start to replace, if you like, these our sources of pleasure that lead to more craving and less satisfaction by sources of pleasure that are more wholesome and more skillful. Because as we've heard from Sangharakshita, emphasising that pleasure in our life in general, particularly in our Dharma life, is crucial. I mean, if we don't have pleasure, we're just not going to do it, really. And we'll be able to do it to some extent, but we won't be able to carry on. But maybe I just want to elaborate a little bit, kind of borrowing from Maitreya Banda's paper, about just a little bit, just fill out this, the kind of pleasure that is the, I'm calling the unskillful pleasure, or the niramisa pleasure. Have I got that the right way around? No, the samisa pleasure. Yeah. In this this law of diminishing returns, and he gives this very lovely little personal experience of himself. As many of us who know him know, Maitreya Banda is a poet himself and has been writing for quite a few years now, quite a number of years. And he said that when he very first, not long after he first started writing poetry, he won a little prize. So he was commended in the Yorkshire Open, so some small poetry competition, he was commended, and he won £15. And he basically said, it sounds like it was one of the happiest days of his life. He won this £15, he says he arrived at the prize giving, presumably had to go up to Yorkshire. He was sat at the front with the other winners. He was one of 10 people got commended, he was one of 10. The judge said something positive about his poem. He got up to read, and then he got his train back to London with his, presumably, his £15 cheque. And he said it was a day of almost unalloyed happiness. But then, interestingly, he says that since then, he's been fortunate enough to win bigger prizes, and he's won some very substantial prizes indeed more money, far more prestige. He said, but none of them gave as much pleasure as that first kiss of success. Yeah, so I thought that's fair, and we can probably recognise that, can't we? And that's the law of diminishing returns. It's what drives all compulsion, isn't it? It's what drives everything from, anything we're sort of addicted to. We remember the first time, which was great, but then we want to repeat that, but it can never be as good again. And apparently psychologists call this the hedonic treadmill, because what happens is we adapt to the good things that happens, and we start taking that for granted. Still on the poetry theme, apparently the poet Robert Frost, who, very, very, the most famous poet in America, many of you have heard of him, and one of the tragedies of his life was his seemingly insatiable desire for praise and honour. He won the Pulitzer Prize 4 times, and he actually said in the end that he didn't care what people thought about his poetry as long as they gave him prizes. So he won more prizes than anyone else ever. He was a genius, but apparently his biographer said he'd always secretly hoped for more recognition than he'd ever received. It's tragedy, really, isn't it? Because it actually, it means if we're in that treadmill, we can't experience our actual happiness. It's like we're sacrificing our actual happiness for something we're imagining in the future. We can't sort of be in the future. The more we yearn for it, the more we get caught up in the shadow of it. It can't make us happy. I think that's kind of takes it. I'm trying to sort of take anything moralistic out of this. It's just simply it can't make us happy because we get used to it. It's not that in a way we've even, in one sense, done anything wrong. We're sort of on the wrong track. That's what we've done wrong. If we've done anything, we think it can, but it actually can't because we're habituated to it. This is why if we accept that a well-lived life, and certainly a Dharma life, needs to have pleasure in it, we will have to find another way. We'll have to find something that hasn't got this addictiveness in it. Because while it's got the addictiveness in it, it will lead to pain. In this kind of samasa, addictive type of pleasure, there's an irreducible amount of appropriation in it. There's an irreducible amount of us trying to add something to ourselves. Whether it's to be thought a success or to have material gain. But that'll ensnare us. It'll sort of alienate us. It'll send us back into this prapancha thing because we'll always be strategizing, working out how to do it, fantasizing about it in the future. As I say, sacrificing our actual happiness in the present for the possibility of success in the future. And I think it's very salutary, isn't it, that thing about Robert Frost? He couldn't enjoy being this genius poet because he just wanted this success. So what can we do about it? We can practice mindfulness and kind of come back to the primary experience. And we can, as I've said, try and look for and identify pleasure that's
that's not got that, it's not seeking to build our sense of self, to come back to pleasure that's an end in itself, that's not us trying to get something, it's just to come back to that end in itself, pleasure. So there's a little Buddhist simile that says to knock out a wooden peg out of a piece of wood, you have to knock in another peg. I really like that, actually. I think we talked about it the other week when Jnanavacha was talking about renunciation. It's like, rather than thinking I've got to give up pleasure because it's addictive, it's just we think, well, what can I find that's more wholesome, that can take its place? What peg can I find to knock that other one out? And so one thing, one way we can look for this is in the world of aesthetics. And again, Sangharakshita has very, very strongly emphasised this. The appreciation of the arts is one of the distinctive things about Sri Ratna. And I think this is why, because a true appreciation of the arts, you let go of that prapancha, you're in a different sort of mode. You're in more that mode of appreciation for its own sake. You're not in a mode of what can I get, what can I gain. Maybe it can't be put into words, but I'm sure we know that sense of maybe looking at something beautiful in art or in nature, where we just, that prapancha, that sort of 50 pence going round, just temporarily stops. We stop comparing, we stop wanting in a particular way, we're just with it, it's a sort of, there's a sort of rightness to it. And it is wordless, actually. There's a sense of harmony, there's a sense of rightness, a sort of effortless attention to it. And there's a wholeness to it. So what we can do is we can consciously cultivate that, not as a kind of added extra to our lives. I think this is the thing that Sangharakshita has emphasised again and again, and I've started to appreciate more and more. It's not just as a sort of sweetener to our lives that he said, oh well, if life gets too much, go to an art gallery or something. It's actually what he's encouraging us to do is live life in more and more in this mode of aesthetic appreciation. And the arts and beauty and nature can be a way in, a very potent way in, but they're not, it's not just that. There's also communication, but there's also the pleasure of, for want of a better word, one might call a clear conscience. And that's the thing I want to just explore in the last few minutes. I promised I'd leave time for discussion. I'm rapidly running out of time. I've been thinking about this notion of a clear conscience. I think I could do with thinking about it much more. Because clear conscience is also very, very traditionally in Buddhism, enumerated as one of the things that's pleasant but without the craving element, that's wholesomely pleasant. There's a word for it which I'll have to look up. So forget it. So freedom from remorse or a clear conscience, I don't quite know how to pronounce this, Avipatisara, I think. That's the word. That's freedom from what, and the feeling associated with it is pamoja. This means delight. It's characterized by a sense of unity and harmony and integration. And yeah, similarly, you could say all the same things about this, as I've already said, that it's important because it's important to have a sense of this because of our human need for pleasure. But what I've been starting to think about is how does this sense of clear conscience relate to this aesthetic sense of that we might feel when we not even, I was going to say look at a beautiful painting, but it's more than look at, isn't it? It's partake of it. It's more dynamic than just passively look at something. And I started to think, oh, clear conscience, there could be a danger that it seems a bit like just the absence of something, like a kind of clean slate. And that would be bad to have a clean slate, but I think it doesn't quite take us far enough if we just think, oh well, I haven't upset anyone recently. I mean, honestly, that's great if we haven't, and that can be a relief. Well, especially for me, who's constantly upsetting people, I can feel a positive delight when I sometimes wake up and I think, oh goodness, there's no one I've upset recently. It can feel positive in its own right. But I was thinking, there must be something more to it than that. It can't be simply, I don't think, that it's a clean slate. I think there must be something more actively creative involved. This is the direction my thinking's taken. And I really enjoy the description of another Tibetan called Gampopa when he's talking about the practice of ethics. And he talks about ethics as a field. I don't know why I'm looking at the book, because that's what he says basically. He says ethics is a field. And I really like that notion of a field because it gives the sense of something that's very alive and, well, something living. It's something that can be flourished. It's something that with attention grows. And I think if one thinks of clear conscience, not just as a clear slate, but as an attitude of bringing into the world more positivity than was previously there, for example, of then that really would be joy. You know, it would be joy in that sort of aesthetic way. It would be pleasure and joy. Well, it would be creative. It's a creative act, isn't it? To bring more metta into the world than there was. I really like this saying, I've often quoted it, of Sangharakshita's, where he talks about the creative mind as loving where there is no reason to love. And that this metaphor of the field really conjures that up for me. It's a bit like something grows where nothing was there before. And to me, that's joy. If I think of living like that, I think, oh yeah, there's a joy in that that's completely wholesome, completely free of that sort of taint of what's in it for me, or that taint of, oh, I'm going to get used to this and then I'll need even more and more and more. It would, again, you get that with the field of abundance. It would just grow without sort of stopping it. So maybe I'll sort of stop there and say that we're going to leave about 5 or 6 minutes in case there's any responses to that. But I think, in summary, talking about Milarepa, the yogi, and the yogi's joy, if there's one thing to remember, just remember that in our Dharma life, well, just the importance of joy, and even if you don't remember the Sanskrit names, that there's these two kinds of pleasure, and that we can look for that in our experience. We can look for, is this pleasure that I'm feeling wholesome or unwholesome? Is it skillful or unskillful? Not that it's bad. Unskillful doesn't mean bad, but is it going to lead me to more freedom? Is it unbounded or is it bounded? We can examine our experience, and I suppose it's like learning to value one above the other, and we probably do know that in ourselves, even when we've kind of all the worst things have happened, you know, life's thrown at us maybe particular sets of difficult things. I think if we can learn to distinguish that kind of unpleasant Vedana from the unpleasant Vedana of I've acted in ways that have gone against my values, we'll be on to it. Or similarly, the other way around, if we can distinguish between the pleasure of behaving skillfully and freely, and if we can inhabit the aesthetic pleasure of that and learn to distinguish that between the diminishing returns pleasure of more mundane pleasure, we'll naturally renounce one from the other. It won't be a difficult thing to do. Okay, so that's it. That's our series on Milarepa. Hesitate to say over. I'm sure we'll revisit it because it's such a rich topic. From next week, Silapir and Jnanavacha and I will be starting a new theme, which is on going for refuge and really exploring what that really means. It's a term that you probably heard. Anyone who's been coming to the centre for any length of time will probably hear this term, going for refuge. But what does it really mean? So we're going to spend a whole series exploring that in different ways. So that's starting next week, taking us up to Christmas. And we've got another visit from Padma Vajra in there sometime. Okay, so that's it. Thank you.